You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. This is The Comedian's Comedian, and today I'm talking to Amy Miller. When I say this is The Comedian's Comedian, I'm referring to the title of the podcast and not me. I am occasionally in interviews referred to as, so you're The Comedian's Comedian. I'm like, I'm absolutely not. But I do also suffer from crippling self-deprecation syndrome. So although I don't think it's fair to say that I am The Comedian's Comedian, I am still one. So today I'm talking to Amy Miller, and blow me tight, she is incredibly good. She's really, really funny US act. She has her whole family apparently have resting dust bowl face, and you can listen on to find out what that means. And we're going to talk about the differences between US and UK comedy, but specifically initially in our conversation about with a chat about kind of gag density and hit rate, in which I'm pleased to hear her sister standing up for the UK end of the bunch. We're also going to talk about why comics don't need to have as many visible teeth in the UK. We're going to talk about appearance and Amy's high self-esteem and the way that she doesn't limit herself. And we're going to have a bit of a conversation about gatekeepers as well, about dealing with late night TV bookers telling her that a joke isn't funny when actually she realises there's an ulterior motive as well. So lots of good stuff here. She's a really wonderful comic, and I highly recommend her special Ham Mouth, which is available as a Comedy Central special on YouTube. And you can also download her album California King on Spotify or presumably any other platform. AmyMillerComedy.com, and her socials are Amy Miller on Twitter and Amy Miller Comedy on Instagram. No extras from this episode. We'll bash through with about an hour and 10. I'll chat to you briefly in the middle, but you can join the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders should you wish to support the podcast and this excellent work. So on with the excellent work. Here's Amy Miller. Great to see you. You might not remember. We met, I think, at South By in 2019.
Yes, I do remember. Definitely. It's nice to see you again.
So are you on the campaign trail at the moment with your... Which one is it that's most recent? Because I've listened to California King and I've watched Ham Mouth. And they're both 2022, are they not?
Yes, they came out right next to each other. So, because Comedy Central used to put out an album to accompany the half hour, but they stopped doing that. So I just kind of timed mine at the same time, separately.
I see.
So that if people discovered me on YouTube, then they could go buy the album and have, you know, a full hour of material. So, yes. Excellent. I'm on the campaign trail for both, I guess.
And how are you doing? Are you doing loads of podcasts? Are you doing loads of interviews and kind of pushing it? Are you the sort of...
I am, yeah. They're booking me on a lot of stuff. I'm doing my best. The promotion gets really exhausting eventually. That was a very confusing question for a second because it's election day here right now.
Oh, is it?
I was like, what? Like, no, I'm not running for city council or anything. I should
and
be.
Where's here at the moment? Are you in California?
Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles.
You're in LA.
Yeah.
Okay, so just give us, for those of my listeners, with British listeners who maybe are unaware of you or less aware of you, have you been over here?
You know what? I am currently planning a trip. So I've never done comedy there. I've spent a decent amount of time in the UK before I started comedy, which I started a little bit late, I guess, relative to other people. I started when I was already in my 30s. So... Okay. I have not done comedy there, and I've met a lot of nice people, and over the quarantine, I did like a lot of shows that were kind of around this time, you know, where it was noon in LA and showtime there. And so, yeah, I've met a lot of nice folks and have a couple of friends I've worked with and have opened for Jamali here in the States.
Okay.
So I'm ready to plan a trip, but I want it to be a long one. So I'm kind of like trying to map out, you know, a month or so to go.
Okay. And where are you in your kind of comedy career at the moment? And I also keep forgetting to do this. I have to set up for my listener just how funny I find you. Your specials are so, so good. And you have, what I love is that you have this kind of like, it's not like deliberately dark. It's not like arch. You're not kind of doing edgelord stuff, but there's some real darkness and what have you. But it's your presence on stage is just fantastic. And you've also got really, really strong, tight, compressed American comedy jokes. Do you know what I mean? Like in the UK,
that's so
I think
nice.
Well, you know, it's word choice and word economy and stuff like that. And it's like I really love to see someone who has all of those things, like really short, punchy jokes and loads of personality and kind of depth and texture and those sorts of things.
Thank you. That is very kind. And I think, you know, some of what you're saying is part of why I want to go spend some time there, because I do think, you know, I watch a fair amount of British comedy, and I spend a lot of time in American comedy clubs. So that's a very nice compliment, but I also want to find some balance there, and I'm looking for kind of like, you know, to spend time in a place where there is a little bit more space to do longer stories, to not just have this obsession, you know, treating every set like it's at the Comedy Cellar or the Comedy Store where I'm like, just, you know, set up, punch. I'm not that kind of comedian. I'm not like a, you know, Mark Norman style, or I don't really do one-liners, but I do end up chopping a lot of my stories to get to a laugh or another tag, because people are so impatient here, and you have to. And, you know, if you're in New York or something, and it's people from, you know, all over the globe watching, you have to just kind of get to it. And I really, really want to find some more space in a lot of, you know, my new bits that I haven't been afforded in the older ones.
That sounds like the right way round to do it. Do you know what I mean? That sounds like it would be, I don't know if easy is the right word, but it sounds like it makes more sense if one were a kind of budding comedian who had the opportunity to live anywhere, it would probably be sensible to do the hard yards in the States and then like get really good at pressing the air out and then come to the UK rather than, I mean, I've done comedy in the States here and there. We, you know, we met in South By and I've done tiny little gigs here and there, but I haven't kind of like to go do it from that way around. I'm used to having some time, you know, I'm used to having some, let's experiment and explore and discover. And that does feel antithetical, I think, to the American standard.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Did you find an adjustment when you were doing shows here that you felt like to rush a little bit more?
Well, yes. I mean, the main thing I did a set on Conan. So that was like I was working with JP, and it was like that was very deliberately a process of take what you think is a 9-minute set and then discover how short that set actually is. So I haven't done, it's not like I've done an hour show in the States. So I haven't kind of felt that. So I've done kind of warm up sets towards the TV spot. I suppose I felt comfortable that I had some short jokes.
Yeah.
Like it was really nice to like my opening wasn't working. And so I had a kind of recovery short joke that I thought, there's a bit I've not used for ages. That's a laugh in 3 seconds. And I think looking back, I was probably thinking, thank Christ I've got those gears.
Yeah.
Because if I hadn't, there isn't time to say hello and get acquainted, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm always kind of jumping back and forth because I do have a very lucky, well, it's not all luck, a lot of it's work, but I'm lucky to get a fair amount of long sets, you know, and because I tour a lot. And and so I do have that space on the road, and I'll develop a new bit and then bring it back to LA or take it to New York or anywhere I'm doing like a short you know, 7-10 minute set. And then I just end up chopping, and almost to an extent that I like forget, you know, what the original recipe was. Like I forget the full story and the setup, because then I take, you know, a 10-minute bit and try to turn it into a 3-minute bit. And it's like, it's really frustrating sometimes, because I know when I started, I felt like I had more. But maybe when you're new here, you know, people don't expect that, like a tag every, you know, 15, 30 seconds or whatever.
Sure.
So, yeah, I really just want to sort of develop both tools in that belt, really.
And is that – sorry, go on.
Oh, no. Partially to make my family happy. My sister is – one of my sisters is extremely supportive of my career, but the only comedians she ever watches are all from the UK. And then she'll show me these clips, and I could, you know, it's very good people that are doing very well and selling out theaters. And but in as I'm watching, I'm like, oh, I'm trying to tag up this story as I watch it. But she just loves it. She's just like, oh, this is so much better than like what you guys do here. Like, you're great, but you know, because she likes that style. And it's just, it's so interesting to watch, because by all accounts, some of the people she's shown me would be bombing in an American comedy club, you know, or they wouldn't have time. They'd be telling half a story. So yeah, I really,
yeah. That's extraordinary, isn't it? That what we kind of, and I'm really pleased to hear that, actually, because it's in, those words are now in your sister's mouth. That's like a legitimate American who's kind of, who preferred, you know, who has seen the best of what America has to offer and kind of goes, well, I also like this style. It's interesting whether that's like, is it texture? What is it that you think she likes? Is it the fact that there's some breathing room and you can kind of go along someone on a journey? I wonder sometimes with American comics, I do feel, I mean, there's that classic, you might be aware of Stuart Lee, the British, kind of widely regarded as one of the best British comics, but he's very acerbic. One of the things he said in a book years ago was that when he went to the Montreal Comedy Festival, it was full of Americans trying to hone 5 minutes about nothing into 3 minutes about even less, which is like, which,
absolutely,
you know, which I'm sort of quoting and falling back on out of a sense of kind of protecting ourselves.
Yes, absolutely. I think she does like the space, and she and because she has an attention span, so she's willing to, you know, she's willing to take the journey. And it's been, yeah, it's been interesting, you know, working with British comics as well, because I've also opened for Russell a few times, Russell Howard, and yep. And I notice even over the course of a weekend that I'll almost adjust my style and go like, oh, okay, you can like, you can relax a little bit, you don't need you don't need
That's
to Chris Rock all over the stage, you know, you can stay in one place. And
yeah, that's interesting with Russell in particular, because he's so energetic.
Yeah.
Like, he's a very kind of, not frantic, but an incredibly energetic kind of storytelling comic. So he isn't someone that I would think of as ever kind of meandering towards a punchline. But I take your point. What he does is, it's like kind of infused with lots and lots of character. But in terms of punch for punch, if you were to see him next to Roy Wood Jr. or something, then bang, bang, you know, like the kind of the frequency of the gags would be very different.
Yeah, yeah, he is very energetic, but he does leave some space there to tell a whole story and kind of spin a yarn, I guess. But we're a good match because I am dry and I don't move around, and he is very frantic.
yeah, sure.
It's a balanced show, yeah.
So what's your favorite way to kind of to meet an audience? Like, what's a kind of... Like, one of my sort of obsessions is I love people's opening lines. And certainly that's kind of one of the areas in which British comedy, in terms of brevity or kind of like impact, does reflect American comedy a little bit. If I think of some opening lines whereby comics kind of go, I'm going to sum up my personality in the first 5 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot. I feel like there's a lot of pressure to do that here. And the problem is I do always try to have a good opening line, but sometimes, you know, I can't. I have one and then I have to retire it. So I can't, like, I have one in this special and I can't, you know, it was also in another sort of televised thing. So I have to stop using it, and it was terrifying. I'm like, what do I say now? Because that is, I think, one of the hardest parts of stand-up, especially in a short set. Or even in a long set where people don't know you, they've just come to the club and they took a chance on whatever comic was there that night and they saw your clips. It's like, yeah, how do I meet these people? I don't know. It's really hard. It hasn't gotten any easier. Like, I have a new one I've been trying out, but it's I'm not as passionate about it, and it's just so weird. I mean, it's a weird thing we do in general to just stand in front of people and pick up in the middle of something. In the middle of a conversation that wasn't going, you know, it's like, yeah. If you just sat at someone's brunch table and, you know, and you're like, so anyway, my mother, you know, yeah. It's like, it's very weird and unnatural. It's an unnatural way to communicate. So I don't know my favorite way. I'm still figuring it out because it's hard. But I, you know, and I've seen friends have the same opening line for, you know, 10, 12 years. And I'm like,
yeah.
I don't want to do that. If I wrote a couple good ones, I can write another good one, but it's really tough.
What was your first opener that you felt like, oh, this is, I thank God I can
walk on. Oh, well, and when I was with my ex, who I talk about in the special, pre-pandemic, I would always say like, oh, I'm so happy to be out of the house. You know, I have a little one back home.
Yeah.
Do you guys have little ones? Oh, ha, 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 clap, clap, clap. And I'm like, I'm not a mom. I just have a really young boyfriend, which was true. He is much younger than me. He still is. He's alive. I didn't kill him. Not yet. But yeah, so thank God for the pandemic. No, because then it became a thing that I could adapt into, like, oh, we're all back out of the house now, you know, and so I'm like, oh, I was stuck in there with my little one, you know,
yeah.
And so it worked for almost a couple more years, but now I'm like, it's, you know, it's 5-6 years old. I need to, I mean, he's not even that young anymore. Like, I got to retire the joke, you know.
That's a shame when you have to retire a joke about someone else's youth. That's like one level further removed.
Yeah, time flies.
What's would you mind telling me the one that you're working with at the moment that you're like, you feel is like, it's kind of working, but
Stuart,
not your favorite?
It's so embarrassing to say jokes out loud. And
I know, but
casual
this is the place for it.
It's very,
but you don't have to.
It's very stupid. It's not even a joke. I've just literally been going like, oh, yeah, you all look cute tonight. You too, Amy. Okay, yeah. Kind of a rude crowd, but we'll get through it. And they're like, ah, you know, because they don't know if they're supposed to answer. And it's just so stupid. And I just like did it one night out of nowhere and it kind of got a laugh. So I've been starting with that. And then,
okay.
But it's so hard to have an opening line. I always like respect when people do it naturally every time.
Yeah.
What do you do?
What do I do at the moment? I'm working. Like, I'm focusing less on club sets at the moment and kind of putting a show together for the Edinburgh Festival. But unusually for me, this year it's a work in progress, so the stakes are much lower. So I think the most recent one, I kind of talk very quickly about the fact that I moved to, I left London, I moved to Bristol against my will. So because I think, like, because one of the challenges I have on stage is I look like a boring winner. So if I can quickly, sort of establish that I'm put upon. Oh no, do you know what? Even before that, something I've been really enjoying is I walk on, and this is pertinent to our conversation. I walk on and take my phone out and put it on a stool or like on, you know, something nearby. And I say, I've been watching lots of American stand-ups on Netflix. And I think a lot of them do is they walk on and they just take their phone out and put it on a stool. So I've started doing that because I think it shows exactly the right amount of disdain for the audience. So that, and I've been really enjoying that because it's a very, unlike a lot of my stuff in that it's not guarded exactly, but it's kind of high status and casual and like suggesting that it's good to feel disdain for them. I think what I like about that line is it puts me in a good mood about the gig. I have a tendency to sort of become a bit of a yappy puppy dog and be desperate to be liked. And it's a really good way of reminding myself that joke to kind of start in the right place.
Yeah, that's very funny. And you know, I'm going to use it.
And it's always make any
easier.
Sense.
Yeah, it's always easier traveling because you can kind of, you know, say something that happened to you in that city that day, or even insult the city. You know, I sometimes like that. You know, starting with disdain, it's, you know, not everyone can get away with it, but I think you know, if you kind of look like you're going to be sweet and then you insult them immediately. I've seen a lot of comics go, what is it? And I don't know who started this, but now it's, you know, becoming a derivative because I've seen a few people do it. But the first person I saw do it was my friend Ben Kronberg, where he like comes out and does nothing and he's reading his notes and, you know, adjusting his water and everything. And it's like an uncomfortably long time. And then he's like, oh, do you start work the second you get to your job? You know, which sure. is very funny.
Yeah.
And I open for Tom Segura a lot, and something he'll do in a very shitty town is he'll go, you know, a lot of people talk shit about Bakersfield and I get it. And that's it. Lovely. And it's so perfect. And like, it's just so funny.
Oh, that's perfect. Because you get to do, it's like, that's a classic have your cake and eat it thing. You get to put it in someone else's mouth and do a spin on it. And it's clear how you feel about the town. That's lovely.
Yeah. I think one of my favorites. He can use it in so many American towns.
Yes.
Almost all of them, too.
Almost all. I think one of my favorites, like on an album that I've seen is Daniel Tosh walking out on stage to rapturous applause and a standing ovation. And mid-ovation, he says, yeah, believe it or not, that gets old. I just love, I mean, talk about status. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Now I'm going to keep it to pay more attention to this weekend and see what people are doing, because it is just, it's so hard. And I always want to avoid the, like, you know, a little bit about me. Like, I feel like that's very, you know, first 3 years of stand-up kind of thing. It's really ages you. In a bad way.
You can carbon date how long they've been going for. I got you.
Totally.
So you were saying there about your about the kind of the relationship you have with the audience. And one of the things I really enjoy in watching you is the kind of you have this lovely giggle, which is a very innocent, you were saying about kind of like appearing to be innocent or appearing to be sweet and then revealing the truth. And that's something that I think you kind of, you play off very well with, you know, you'll talk about not to, you know, there's people do lots of stuff about their appearance, but like that idea of like looking like a middle school teacher and, you know, not even that line, but just had that awareness of yourself is like, this is how these people are reading me. Is that something?
Yeah. That used to be another opener that I would use. Was just, you know, I would literally go, don't worry, I've done this before. They didn't just let a second grade teacher on stage. Like, let's let her try it out, you know.
I'm interested in how you sort of discovered, like, how did you as a comic discover what people thought of you?
Well, because I think, like all of us, it's something I've been kind of thinking about most of my life. And I think I made a mistake the first few years fighting that rather than embracing that sort of conflict, like, and a lot of it I just didn't understand, you know. When I started, I didn't yet know that a lot of the time when I get on stage, people are going to immediately assume that I'm not going to be good, not just for sexism reasons, which is certainly there, but because I don't look like I would be a funny person. And I have always observed this because I think, you know, as a kid, I was incredibly, incredibly shy. But I've always been sort of funny, but in a way that you get funny as like the youngest child, where you, like, I was pretty silent, but I would pick my moments and make sure they counted, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And so I just know that most of my life in one-to-one interactions, like, people on average are surprised when I say something funny. So for the first few years, I would like try to fight that and go like, you know, I'm going to come out strong. I'm going to show them I'm in charge. And then eventually I was like, you know what? Why don't I use it? Like, I mean, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. a less so now that I feel more comfortable just on stage and in my act, because I know that even if the first few minutes don't, you know, they're not sold yet, like, I'm going to get them. So I don't have that anxiety. But, you know, for the first few years, we all have that anxiety. And eventually I just started to use it and go like, okay, like, let them assume this is going to be bad, you know, and then they'll be surprised. Or the opposite, like, assume I'm going to be just very sweet, without any sort of darkness or edge. Or the other thing is that I'm going to be purely self-deprecating. And I think that through combination of myth and reality, like a lot of crowds think, oh, if I see a woman do stand-up, she's going to insult herself. And so I very much always come from the other angle where I'm like, even if there's some self-deprecation in the setup or the story, I always end up winning. Like I'll end up being on top, and that's a lot of my very transparent joke structure is just like, here's something bad that happened to me, and then this awful thing that I ended up doing in the end, you know, or saying.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really interesting observation. That I don't know if I'd realized that kind of coherently myself, but yeah, of course, 100%. That's one of the things that makes you so attractive in comedy terms, is that you win. You just win all the time, and it's lovely to see a what do they call the writer of the Jack Reacher novels? He said he wanted him to be an overdog. He just has so many underdogs, and actually being an overdog, he wins every fight. He's an overdog. Get over it. You know, there's something about that, which particularly coming from you, coming from your mouth, is really celebratory.
Yeah. And I think even though I thought about the sort of these qualities on a personal level, I didn't think about it all the way comedically until it was sort of on a bigger stage, or you know, a bigger audience. Like when I did Last Comic Standing and I was a very new comic and I had, you know, even like pixie cut bangs and little curls in my hair, like very sort of infantilized look. And then I did my darkest material that I had at that time that they would allow on the show because it's network. Yeah. And that was calculated. And then seeing the responses and reading the reviews, I was like, oh, this is very interesting, because people are either like, there's no middle. Like, people either love it or they hate me because they can't figure it out. It was very like, is she old or is she young? Is she sweet or is she a cunt? Is she, you know, is she fat, thin, or medium? Like, it was just, you know, is she hot or am I disgusted by her? Like, it was just so, like, polarizing in this weird way that I was like, oh, I need to just use this. Like, you know, and the people who are going to love me right away are going to, but everyone else is going to remember me, at least, even if they're not into it. And that's, I think, very powerful.
Yes, but that's exactly what I was going to ask, is whether that felt like a kind of a source of power or an opportunity. Because that's the worst thing, really, you want, is the, you know, the thing that kind of clangs round my head in my darkest nights of the comedy soul, is that Patton Oswalt quote in one of his routines where he says about, like, starting off with comics, some of them are going to be good, some of them are funny, but who gives a fuck? And that idea of being funny, but who gives a fuck? I'm like, oh my God, that cloud of, that's my imposter syndrome kind of, you know, that's the arrow that I fire at myself.
Yes.
So to know that you have that thing where, if they hate me, great. What a relief.
Yeah. And they don't have like a good reason to hate me. You know, I mean, at best it would be just like, oh, you know, this subject matter is too dark, or, you know, whatever, but it's really the conflict that's making them hate me, like, because they can't sort of figure me out. But there is also a layer of sexism to that too, where it's like, sure, yeah, I can be layered. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's a world where you can be like attracted to me and not feel like you're going crazy because I'm not like, you know, I don't look like Nikki Glaser or whatever, who's very funny, wonderful lady, obviously, not talking shit, but yeah. You know, there is this sort of like, if you are going to be a female comic in the States, like, you know, we want you to look a certain way, so that at least we know, if we're polarized about your material, at least we know we want to fuck you for sure, you know. But it's like, but you do want to fuck me, you're just not sure why, and that makes you mad. Not you personally, but but that's sort of how my whole life has gone too, just interacting with people. So it's been very interesting to apply it to comedy and think a lot about it, you know.
Go on. This is like, I'm really fascinated. I'd love to hear more about that. Your whole life has been like that, that you kind of have this sense that you're kind of wrong-footing people, or that people are attracted to you but mad about it. Like,
yeah.
that's an extraordinary quality, and that's such an unusual observation.
Or just that there's this thing in my family too where like a lot of women, like we look like we're mad at you, but when we're not, and it's very like I usually have my heart on my sleeve. I don't have a lot of ulterior motives. So if you're reading something else, like this is your own shit, you know.
Yeah.
I call it resting dust bowl face, and it's just, you know, we don't emote a lot facially, I guess. I think I'm like better than my mom, and my mom was better than her mom, and we're sort of evolving finally. But yeah, there's just, I don't know. I've always noticed people just project things onto me, and I didn't know why. And you know, I'll hear from comics. Like I did a podcast yesterday where this comic was like, you know, you're truly like one of the kindest people I've met in comedy. I'm not saying this to brag. I'm saying this because I laughed so hard and I was like, that's really nice. And I thank you so much. And I love that is true for you. But then why are there a handful of people that just like absolutely hate me? And I don't know why. I truly don't know why. And I haven't wronged them or anything. You know, they're just like not my cup of tea. But yeah,
and so what you're saying is your theory is that those people are imprinting their own prejudices on what's actually a smiling, innocent face.
Yeah, probably so. I mean, Stuart, this is also why I want to come to the UK. Do you know what I mean? It's like I watch British television because there are more people with my face on it. And like, yeah. You know, and many of them are leading ladies. Like here I have to be, you know, the bitchy secretary or some sort of like incompetent assistant. You know, and it's like, oh no, you can just like have this face and like be on television in the UK and
yes.
No one feels weird about it or like unsure. You know, I can be a lead lady detective or something. And yes, I'm like, maybe I should just get an agent there because, you know, you don't have to have as many visible teeth. where you live, you have some and they're very beautiful, but you
thank
know
you
what I
careful
mean.
Right, yeah. I mean, I do know what you mean, but I think it would be racist of me to agree with you against my own people.
And even amongst the women comedians you have that are successful, it's like they're not all rail thin, you know.
No,
they don't all
no,
look like models. Yeah,
no, that's a pretty new thing in the UK, is there are now so many comedians that some of us are incredibly good looking. Some of us comedians.
Oh,
I don't mean us
on.
I don't mean us either. What I mean is some comedians are now incredibly good looking because there are and they're legit funny as well, because like I think the like for a long time what British audiences wanted was a loser and an appalling car crash of a human being that we could go, oh, this person represents all that is bad about me. And
yes.
Now, you know, that's kind of changing. But
and
I wanted
we've
to
always had that here for men, for sure.
Ah. Yes,
you know,
okay.
The Louis of the world, and you know, you can be this sort of schlubby and like talk about shitting all the time and be like, nobody wants to fuck me, and like people mm-hmm. love it. But when you do that as a woman, it's, you know, people are like, oh, it's a little bit uncomfortable. So we would prefer if you just looked like a model and then put yourself down. And it's like, yeah. Well, I'm not going to do either of those things. So I hope you like it. You know, I'm going to call myself hot while maybe you don't think I am. But like, but you will want to have sex with me by the end of this set.
So this is Amy. Really fun to talk to her. She is really smart and really incisive and just a wonderful, wonderful comic. So I hope you check her out. Just get in touch with me and let me know. Well, because I know some of you do make efforts on social media to point out that you are seeing people from the back catalogue. And I do hope that you are being introduced to new people from this show. We talk a little bit, I think, off mic at the very end of this episode. We spoke about how Amy might end up coming over to the UK. So it would be really nice to know that if you're a fan, you've heard her on this and you'll spot her and make an effort to go and see her. I don't have any data on how many of you listen, how many of you, the individual listener, the one of you that listens, in what
size. This is an impossible sentence to finish. But I don't know how many of you use the show to go, oh, right, obviously, if there are people you've really heard of who are huge in the UK, the numbers are a bit bigger in terms of plays and some downloads and what have you. But then there's a healthy amount of people that listen when there's someone that you may be less aware of. And I would be fascinated to know whether you, the kind of the casual listener, then make an effort to seek people out. I think the hardcore do, the insiders do. And then the hardcore, which is like the insiders, kind of less engaged financially than an insider, but less casual than you filthy casuals. But thank you for listening to this. Thank you for sharing it wherever you can. Go to Amy Miller's website, amymillercomedy.com, and go to comedianscomedian.com to find out about a couple of things. There is now a little floating advert there for tickets to two things at Edinburgh. I'm going to be up there at the 4th to the 11th at the Monkey Barrel at 1:25 in the afternoon, which is an insane time, in a 150-seater, which is an insane room size for doing a week of new material. So please help me not embarrass myself by coming along. I think the tickets are cheap. I feel like they're only £6. And it's new, but it's going to be really live, fun, good new. And let's not forget, in 2019, Primer, my new material show, was arguably the best thing I've ever done. So let's reprise that. It's called A Shared Illusion. 1:25 in the afternoon is when most people in Edinburgh will be at work or having lunch. So please come along and support that. Comedianscomedian.com for links to that. And also a live Comedians Comedian podcast at the Monkey Barrel at 23:20. That is 20 minutes past 11 o'clock at night on Sunday the 7th. Just the one live ComCom. We were talking in the ComCom Facebook group about a meetup. Why don't we do it there? Come along and see that. I am in the process of booking the guest. There's a couple of irons in the fire. They're all very exciting. So please come along and support that. All of those tickets for both A Shared Illusion, my work in progress show, and the live ComCom are at the Edinburgh Fringe this year, are available at comedianscomedian.com or at stuartgoldsmith.com, where you can find out about all the other stuff I'm up to, including cracking 10,000 followers on Instagram. I've been boring you senseless with my little viral journey, but currently on Instagram Reels, I have 4 clips with over 1 million plays each. And it is very exciting to be doing social media on my own terms and simply using it as a means of showcasing my act rather than inviting you into more of my life than you are welcome to. So isn't that nice? Comedianscomedian.com or stuartgoldsmith.com. Right, let's get back to Amy Miller as we talk in this second section about booking policies, about gatekeepers, and about why other female comedians have privately got in touch with her and said, no, no, don't talk about being 40. Let's find out. Back to Amy. Is there an element of your sort of discovery about what works for you on stage whereby you have to accept the truth of what you are? Like, did you go into comedy expecting that you would be, when you were talking about like doing Last Comic, looking in a particular way and gradually realizing, oh, this is how they see me, therefore my options are to work sort of within or against that? I sort of, just to clarify what I'm talking about, like, I think for a long time I've wanted to be cool. Do you know what I mean? Like, I thought, oh, I'll be a comedian and then I'll be cool at last. Yeah. And of course, you become a comedian, you're like, no, they've x-rayed me and they see exactly what I am and I'm pretty cringy. Oh, shit. Do you know what I mean? but you can't fight against it. You right. have to go, this is the truth of what I am. Was there any kind of element of that in your...
I think, you know, I try not to make it sort of my main motivation, but it is one ingredient in the recipe that I think about. I don't want it to ever stop me from, you know, developing certain material or saying certain things or working certain rooms or going after particular opportunities. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I don't want to limit myself, but I definitely think about it. It's also changing, you know, and it's changed not just as I've gotten like stronger as a comic over the last 12 years, but just, you know, sort of in comedy, there's a little bit more freedom here now to like,
yeah,
look different ways. But yeah, I mean, it's something I think about. But this is the thing, is that you are cool. I guess for whatever reason, I was sort of cursed with high self-esteem, but I think because of being funny, like, and so many comedians start comedy and they're not naturally funny people. I mean, how many comics have you hung out with that you're like, this is not, you know, I have more hilarious hometown friends than a lot of the comedians that I hang out with. And my family is very funny because poor people are just funny. And so I think because my family is very like that, like just sort of like, we don't give a fuck about what you think about us and we're hilarious. And being funny is always a power. Like, you are cool because you're funny, like, you know, and so you can sort of look like anything and still be the coolest person in the room, whatever that means to you. So I think that that's helped, like, sort of starting from a place where even 1 year in, when I didn't have, you know, I wasn't comfortable on stage, I still thought, like, I am funnier than all these people, though, because no one's funny, like, no, almost no one. You know, you go out in the world and you talk to people and try to crack a joke with your server or whatever, or the lady at the bank, and just nothing. And it's like, oh, no, you're wrong. But every once in a while when it clicks and you do have that moment with a person where, like, they laugh and they're funny back and you're like, oh, thank God, there's just another funny person in the world today, you know?
That's a really lovely way of putting it. I do know what you mean. I know that sensation of like, oh, you're right, no one in the world is funny. Like, it's staggering. I mean, obviously loads of people in the world are funny, but in a sort of normal day, people are, I guess, I wonder if the lady in the bank is less funny because she's at work and she doesn't like it and she has to deal with you or me or whoever, you know, and maybe actually in a different context, she'd be the hilarious one of her friends. But I don't know.
Maybe so. But it's like, I mean, it's sort of why I feel confident we will always have comedy and we will always have stand up. And even if, you know, the naturally funny people won't work as much as, you know, the TikTok famous people, whatever, that's fine. We're still going to be around because it's true in every other place in life. You know, it's actors who we find funny, you know, are always the most beloved. If you see a band where the lead singer actually is naturally funny, you're like, oh, this was such a better show than other shows. Yeah. And someone told me in 2016 when Trump was running, I don't remember who it was, but someone said, you know, the funniest candidate always wins. And then I start thinking about, like, every American president in my lifetime and going, oh fuck, this guy's going to win. Like, he's going to, because a lot of my friends did not believe it was possible. And I'm like, it is so true. Like, the way that our culture values that so heavily is like, yeah. So that's all to say is I do think about sort of what I am and who I am and how people assess me, but ultimately I'm like, I don't know, I can make you laugh because you're mostly, other people are not funny.
what would you say have been the kind of the major changes in direction or in rhythm when you look back over the last 12 years of your comedy career? Like, what have been the biggest moments that changed you along the way?
I definitely think, you know, the last comic thing, because not only was I new and I was, you know, for the first time kind of reading and hearing like how a very large audience perceived me, but it was sort of some really early validation from people that I like worship comedically. You know, I mean, Wanda Sykes produced the show, so she cast me and coached me, and, you know, even that was like, I mean, she's the funniest person in the world to me, and now I open for her. So it's like, but then the panel, like Roseanne was on the panel, and Norm and Keenan Ivory Wayans, and just getting good feedback from them is, I just thought, because there are so many imposter syndrome moments, especially, you know, if you are aware that you don't maybe like look a certain way that like particular gatekeepers want, or you don't have the right personality, because also in the States, you know, a lot of gatekeepers really love women comedians who are just so grateful to be here and, you know, not like outspoken and have opinions and are fully formed adults, but just like, I'm a sweet little girl and I tell my little jokes and, you know, I'm Just a promise to stay thin and have a voice of a mouse. So it was like just to get sort of validation that I was supposed to be doing this and was good at it. Like that was a very big milestone for several reasons. You know, Roseanne is like very nutty now, but she got in a lot of trouble at one point during the filming because she like came to find me backstage and tell me like, oh, you were my favorite. And I'm like, and she's not supposed to talk to the contestants because it's like technically a contest. And so she kind of got yelled at by the producers. But I was just like, man, like if anyone in comedy has formed my sense of humor or that I saw my family reflected back on TV, like there's no one else, you know. But it's those the moments still creep up, like, you know, every other night, even currently, where I'm like, am I supposed to be doing this? Because I don't see anyone else who really has the same style as me. Like, I don't feel like I can be compared to anyone, which is supposed to be a good thing. But then
it's
does
a great thing.
You know, sometimes it makes you feel like, oh, I'm not supposed to be doing this. And especially when, because you also get like negative external validation where certain gatekeepers or opportunities will say like, no, you know, I don't like it or she's not good. And I'm like, is that true? Like, am I not good? No, I think it's just not for you, you know, you 21-year-old trust fund agent or whatever. It's like, no, it's just, you're not my audience. So that was a big thing. And then I think, I don't know, a lot of it has just been sort of the places I've been able to work and just that I've always worked, you know, and early on, you know, I would get on festivals I really wanted to do and be able to work clubs that were just sort of legendary in my mind. And even now when I get down, I'm like, no way, but I work at the Comedy Cellar and she's the pickiest, you know, and she books based on funny. She might be the only American gatekeeper that does literally book people based on funny and nothing else. So I'm like, I'm doing okay. You know, I'm supposed to be doing this, but it still is very weird that I'm doing this. It was a fluke. So I don't know. It's been a lot of small moments and a lot of just who has taken me out on the road or like who I've been able to work with that I go like, okay, well, I'm not fucking this guy, so he must really think that I'm funny.
It must be. It's so strange to me that, like, even because that is one of the most powerful weapons, I guess, that any comedian can have is to be able to say there's no one really like me. Like, what? How an extraordinary thing! I know people who kill for that, but isn't it so true? It's like a testament to how comedians' minds work, maybe how people's minds work, that one can turn that into a problem.
Well, yeah, because it's not a problem internally and it's not a problem with crowds. And I do want to believe 100% of the time that it's an asset. But you know how the industry works, Stuart. It's like they want to go, she's like this. She goes in this category of person, you know. And so if you can't be compared to anyone, like it is also professionally limiting whether or not it's comedically an asset. And I am totally aware of that. But there's nothing I can do about it. Do you know what I mean?
That's so, it's yeah, no, sure. That's just extraordinary though. That, I mean, I get what you mean. I just would never have imagined that. Surely like for any, and I suppose what I'm talking about is like the bookers, you know, Charlie at South By or JP Buck, you know, the few American, I mean, gatekeepers, if you like, but people who are like really positive and really, really love comedy and love the bones of comedy. I suppose I've had quite limited. I've been lucky. I've had limited exposure to the American circuit, and it's through people like that who really love it, and who are people who I guess would really prize exactly that quality we're talking about. I haven't been exposed much to the people who are like, we've got to put you there and stick you there. So that would never have occurred to me that there would be a downside to being so unique.
Right. Yeah. Well, there are similar gatekeepers that might be positive, but you know, that's your experience, because there's still, sure, they still have to have their own cup of tea. You know, they're not going to book someone. And I have had, and I won't say who, but another, you know, late night booker type person say things to me as we were kind of trying to work out a set, because I haven't done a late night set yet. And I think this is part of the reason, like what we're talking about. I think also just because it's, I have a lot of dark, not clean material, for sure. And that's on me, because I could write a clean 5 minute set. I don't, it's not like what I get excited about. So it's hard when you're just writing for this one thing. But I have had, you know, one of those guys say to me, like, this joke isn't funny. And I'm like, well, that's not true. Because I've done it all over the country 1,000 times, and I wouldn't send you a joke that wasn't funny. So what would be helpful to me is if you said, this isn't right for the show, or I don't like it, then that's fine. Because these guys all still have their preferences. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, and that's the thing about Esty at the Comedy Cellar, and why I do, you know, very biased, I'm a company man, but she books people she doesn't care for sometimes, because she just watched the crowd respond. And she go, it's not for me, but they like it, so, you know. And I think that's a better way to gatekeep, personally, is just like, are you good at this or not? It is a one-to-one formula. If people laugh, you're doing a good job. That's it.
Yeah.
But that's starting to matter less and less, I feel like. So yeah, I have had late night bookers especially where I'm like, I know that I sent you a good set, but you just don't prefer me. And so you're not going to give me the opportunity. And what can you do?
Yeah.
Move to the UK. It's like dating that way. Absolutely. It's very much like dating that way. You know, people don't always date the person that would be best for them, or, you know, that they can fully recognize it's a good match. They date the people they want to be seen with, and, you know, that, like, they've decided, or, you know, I don't know. This is a bad analogy, probably.
Yeah, but. No. I get what you mean. I think it's interesting what you say about that, you know, an exchange regarding stuff being too dark, for example, that you could write a clean set. You could write a clean TV-friendly set, but aren't inspired to do that. And I think that's really good, that, you know, to stick to your guns on that level, I think is really good, because, you know, it's an industry and it's hard, and we're all trying to get by, and we're all trying to make the most of, you know, most of the opportunities available to us, get more opportunities. And I think that's a way in which we've all seen comics slip up, really, is to try and please people. And I think actually that's really important to say, no, that's not me. That's not what I do.
I have been inspired to do so, and I have, you know, and I've sent, you know, all these guys, like, different versions of clean sets over the years that I think work, and I've tried in rooms and they've worked. But I think they can almost pick up on, like, maybe they can't always put words to it, but, like, oh, this isn't, you know, they'll say, like, this joke isn't funny, or it's not working, or it's not a good fit. And I'm like, so you can also tell that I'm not as passionate about these jokes. But, you know, like, it's coming off when I deliver them, because it's not what I get the most excited about. I'm not, like, attempting to be, like, shock humorist. I just end up writing about dark stuff because, I don't know, I'm processing it, I guess. But, you know, there is also, sorry to keep coming back to sexism, but I will say, you know, other gatekeepers in similar positions have allowed men more freedom to be A, alternative, and B, dark. And white men in particular. So, because it's still a thing that I have friends working on late night sets for the other shows who are trying to talk about race. And then they're like, no, it bums out the crowd. So please don't mention that you're black. You know, like, we can see. So there's just, like, certain people are allowed a little bit more freedom to be trusted. Just have that inherent trust, right? I don't always have that, even though I test my material almost every night. You know, I would never send something that wasn't working. I'm just like, oh, you just don't trust me. But this guy, mm-hmm. it's like, go do your weird shit or do a very dark set or whatever. And women for sure have to be sort of a little bit, I don't know, in their minds, more palatable. But it's like the audience is changing too. Like the audience is getting younger and they're used to women doing comedy now. So like, yeah. don't overthink it, guys. Like, and it's really hard because they'll say, write about your life, do a personal set. And I'm like, well, if I do a personal set, there's going to be some dark shit in there because life is a nightmare, you know? And mine has not been particularly great. So if I talked about my childhood, it's not going to be about cereal or whatever, you know? Yeah. And it's, we've just never been allowed this same sort of freedom. And this is also true for comics of color and queer comics and, you know, everyone who's not you type of thing.
I'm glad you said you rather than simply gesturing towards me and leaving that unsaid. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I realized yeah, I realize that more and more every day that it's, you know, that I've had a pretty easy ride in comedy. I haven't got everything I wanted, but there's a ton of things I haven't had to deal with. So, yeah.
Yeah, many, many things I haven't had to deal with just by nature of being a white comic, for sure. Mm-hmm. And I know that.
Tell me about your kind of happiest place on stage. In terms of your material, like from the whole of your back catalogue, what would you say was your most favourite or a really favoured bit to do? And is that, like, is it always the case that the bit that gets the most banging laugh is your most favourite piece to be inhabiting, to actually be performing?
Oh, no. No, it's usually the opposite for me. That the things that I sort of, like, devilishly laugh at on stage don't get the biggest response, because they do tend to be probably a little bit darker because, I don't know, and I'll just giggle because I'm like, this is making people uncomfortable, but but the working out of the joke is very funny and fun to me, and it always ends up being the opposite.
That's funny that you've got, I don't know what the term is, it's not quite a tag, but a couple of times in the specials and in some other stuff of yours I saw, you'd do a line that makes people sad and then go, that made you so sad. Like really, like a really sort of upbeat, smiling acknowledgement of the fact that, yeah, that, you know, you found that hard to laugh at.
Yeah, and it should be hard to laugh at. It's a dark subject matter, but like we have to, I think I say at some point in the special, like, that's why we have to laugh at it, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah.
I did enjoy, I think I do always have fun with the sort of shitting on tall guys joke, because there are so many pieces of that that are kind of dark, but it's also like literally punching up, you know, and it's something that you can walk away having any feeling you want about it, but ultimately no tall man has come up to me to say like, this is not okay, because they're doing fine, you're all doing fine, you know. It's going well, and so I always really really enjoy that one. Plus I get hit on by a lot of hot short guys after, so that really helps.
I love the kind of anecdotal / data that you get given after performances. If you do a certain piece of material over and over again, you go, well, the experiment has revealed some interesting data.
I think that's true across the board. You don't always know your favorites until they're reflected back at you, or you know, sometimes the response after the show is the most fun part of it, if it's a good response like that, you know, or if it's something that pissed people off. But I'm having a lot of fun right now in a new joke that really, really is bumming people out. And I don't know if I'll be able to keep it. I think if there's a couple spots I can inject some more lightness, but it is about my youth pastor growing up who is in prison for child molestation. You know, and he didn't get me. I say that in the joke, like, you know, I mean, I thought I was cute. I don't know what this guy was looking for, but But people are so turned upside down by it. It's an abortion bit that goes into the child molestation. You know, I'm not doing this on purpose. It's just stuff I need to talk about. It's like,
are you slightly doing it on purpose? We've talked about the kind of the devilish nature of it and kind of, you know, what kind of excites you about being on stage. There is some part of you which really enjoys the fact that people, like, enjoys that kind of wounded noise as well as a laugh.
I think the rascal behavior comes in continuing to do the bit after seeing these responses, but it doesn't start from that foundation. Yeah. It really starts from, I have to talk about this right now, you know, and in thinking about the abortion fight, like, I've spent a lot of time thinking about the hypocrisy of the religious right, and because I grew up with these people, you know, and so it really does start from a very authentic place. But then, you know, I am laughing on stage and now just at how sad it makes people. But, you know, who never, ever gets bummed out about it is people who are actually molested. They like those jokes the most because they're like, fine, thank you. Someone's talking about it, you know, and they're doing okay. It's a very common thing. It's not okay, but it happens.
For the benefit of the listener, Amy chose a fantastic opportunity there to drink from a large blue mug with Wonder Woman all over it.
Oh, yeah. My niece got me this.
That's very good. Very well timed. So what do you want out of comedy, ultimately? Are you content to... Because you said you came to it kind of later in life. You came to comedy later in life, in your 30s. But for some comics, that's later.
Yeah, for most,
And what do you want out of it, ultimately? Can you foresee a point at which you're kind of satisfied and no longer hungry for the next thing?
That is a good question. And I think being in my 40s has made me spend a lot more time thinking about this because, you know, I didn't really think midlife crises were real. I thought they were for, like, dads who were sick of their wives, who wanted to get a hot car, you know. But I think, and then especially, you know, sort of coming out of this pandemic, a lot of friends my age are, it's very natural to go through this, like, what does my future look like? Like, will I have financial stability? Am I going to be on the street or will someone be wiping my ass, you know? And so I'm sort of there with it.
You really distilled the two poles there.
yeah, you know, because, and I'm still young for the regular world, by the way, but for comedy, for the industry, not for stand-up, but for the industry, I guess a senior citizen now. I don't know.
Well, that's it. You mentioned other female comics getting in touch and saying, no, don't talk about being 40 on stage.
Yeah.
Like a lot of other comics? Was that a real thing?
A lot. And there's a lot of comics I know that are still lying. And, you know, and that's their journey. And it is more effective for sure for getting cast in things and even getting stand-up opportunities. Like, maybe I should be lying financially, but I just, it's so antithetical to, I feel like, what stand-up is about. It would be very strange to do. So not my choice, but yeah, I have a lot of friends who are still doing it. I think there's also a generation of female stand-ups that are now all on the cusp or have just turned 40 and they are out about it. It's so crazy that we're talking about this. Like, yeah, like nobody cares that Bill Burr is like 55 or whatever. Like, it never crosses anyone's fucking mind. But so I think it'll start to shift a little bit as this generation of like very successful women comics, like Nikki and Whitney and Amy Schumer, you know, now that they're like, I'm in my 40s, like, sorry, you know, still funny, still hot, like, but yeah, I did get that feedback a lot. To answer your question in the longest way possible, I think any sort of stability is kind of my goal right now. So if that means like getting to a place where I'm like an established enough stand-up that is my future, you know, like a Kathleen Madigan sort of style where it's like, I mean, what, you know, I can't name something that Kathleen Madigan has acted in or written on. She just is an incredible stand-up, and people know her, and she sells out theaters, and that is her retirement plan. That would be great. If that means writing on a show, getting a union job, like acting on a show, great. But right now, there's no stability and no plan for the near or distant future. And that is very, very scary, because then you go like, what am I doing? You know, like, you know, our parents just worked jobs and had benefits and then retired. And you do that partially so that you're not 60 years old living at the creek.
Yeah, that is. I mean, that occurs to a lot of us, I think, at a certain point, that like, as we in our 20s maybe or 30s are like, yeah, I've beaten the system. Look at me. I've walked between the raindrops and do not need to concern myself with such mortal affairs as a pension plan.
Yeah.
You know, and then to realize as you get older, oh, no, that is why people made those tedious choices, I eschewed.
Yeah. And because I'm still sort of a preteen or teenager in comedy, because I started late, you're like 12 years in is not like, well, coming up on 12, is not in the scheme of things that long of a comedy career yet. You know, I mean, Burr, for example, has probably been doing it for 35 years. You know, it's like almost as long as I've been alive. So I saw Leslie Jones on stage the other night at the Comedy Store, and she said she started comedy in 1982. And I was just like,
Christ.
Fuck, like, that's insane, you know? And yeah, it makes sense. It all adds up. But it's like, but again, you know, very inspirational, because she got SNL in her late 40s. And that's like, okay, that's cool, you know? Yeah. Unfortunately, black women age much better than we do, so that's good for them. But yeah, I'm really just, there are things I want to accomplish and things to kind of tick off the list, but the goal right now is really just like, feel like I'm supposed to be doing this and I still have a future in it, and I'm going to continue to progress in stability rather than be, I don't know, on cruise ships. I would do that, though. I would do cruise ships. That's
You're
fine.
You're not clean enough for cruise ships. You couldn't possibly do a cruise ship.
That's true. You're right. I forget about that. Yeah, very polarizing. They would throw me into the sea, probably.
You mentioned there, just to, before we wrap up, you mentioned it would seem antithetical to the nature of stand-up, to like what stand-up is about. So what is it about for you? What's the... Like, are you kind of a sort of warrior poet type of stand-up, or are you kind of speaking truth to power, or expressing your inner truth, or what? Like, what does it mean to you?
It means a combination of those things. It is really, for me, like, writing stand-up is presenting your point of view and your values in a way that's funny and true, whether or not all the stories are necessarily real or the setups, you know, whether or not this happened last week or 6 years ago. The core of it is that these are my values, and by the end of this set, you will have some idea of who I am. Like, I'm leaving baggage on the stage, you know what I mean? Those are always the stand-ups that I loved growing up. And people I looked up to when I started is just like, who can I watch and go like, oh, I've gotten to know you. And yes, definitely speaking truth to power. That's always been important to me in my life. It's been a detriment to me in many ways, professionally, in every job I've ever had. You know, just pointing out things that are unfair or unjust. And, you know, that is really what gets me out of bed in the morning. And then, you know, and then the number one thing, this is all, I'm counting down, we're doing it Letterman style. And the number one is just making it funny. And a lot of that is relatability, I think. So for me, it's like, yeah, the biggest laughs are always going to be because a large percentage of the people in the room saw themselves in it or someone they know and they just relate. And that connection is like all of it for me, you know, because when you're not connecting, you don't get laughs. You know, I mean, that is like truly how we get them, because someone goes like, oh, I know what she's talking about and I can apply it to my own life. Or this is a thing I'm also, you know, pissed off about. And she is speaking truth to that power. And like, that's, yeah, this is the human connection of it all, really, that is the most exciting. It's the luckiest thing we get to do. It's like, we're kind of manipulating. It's a little, it is a little magic trick, you know, we're manipulating people's feelings, manipulating a whole group. And I was a teacher for years. And so I'm like, that is a specific skill, but it's that connection that I really, really love. Like connecting through presenting my own point of view is like, it's just so special. We love it, don't we, Stuart?
So that was Amy Miller. Thank you so much to Amy for coming along. She's just so, so funny. Do check out Hammouth, the Comedy Central special on YouTube, and also California King. And she's got bundles of other stuff. She's got an album called Solid Gold, which I haven't yet got to, which I'm saving up for when I've got a drive coming up. Thanks to Nathan Wood. Thanks to Moz for logging. Thank you to Callum Morin, who is now my Instagram guy. And if you too would like to know how to get millions and millions of plays and subsequently like an 86% increase in followers, then get in touch with Callum Morin, but through me. I'm his agent, okay? You get in touch with me and I put you onto Callum, because you're all going to want to get in touch with Callum. He can't do all of you and he's mine first. But he is very good, so please, you can get in touch with him. I mean, genuinely through me, but I'm not his agent and I won't be taking a percentage. So thank you to everybody. Thanks to who has been really useful this week? Oh, the podcast mother. The podcast mother herself, Emily Crosby, has now completed completed because the archive is not complete. But we now have the most coherent archive of ComComPod episodes, WABs, blurbs, write-ups, everything else. I've got way more logs than I thought I have. I'm going to do a little crowdsourcing project, which I've been planning since 2020, where you, if you are interested in doing so, can listen back to a favourite episode and create a little log for me. I could just get them all auto-transcribed on otter.ai, which I'm not being paid to advertise, but I think is excellent. But it might be that it sort of would be nice to have someone kind of inject a little bit of their personality into the log, as the loggers do. So I'll contact you about that more as and when I can. At ComComPod on Twitter. Oh, all of Amy's stuff. Let's just remind you, Amy Miller Comedy. Amy Miller Comedy on Instagram and Amy Miller on Twitter. And do check out her specials. Go to comedianscomedian.com to find out about the Edinburgh Fringe live podcast with a guest TBC. As soon as I know, I'll put it on comedianscomedian.com, but buy a ticket now anyway. It's cheap. And you can come and see me doing new material from the 4th to the 11th of August in the Edinburgh Festival at the Monkey Barrel at 1:25 p.m. Bring a sandwich. I don't know if that's allowed. So that's all of that. What was the other thing? There was another thing. I'm trying to be really on this because I saw a devastating but accurate tweet where someone had talked about how the first 10 minutes of all podcasts is a load of inane shit. And someone very kindly stood up for me and said, that's why ComCom does it at the end. So I've tried to be even more on it than I normally am. We'll talk about Edinburgh in a post-amble. But yeah, do go to those websites, check out those things, support the stuff, and share the episodes. And particularly if you've enjoyed this and you're not listening in the UK, then please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you are in the UK or anywhere, just rate me. I think if you're on Spotify, you can rate it 5 stars. I'm listening to all my podcasts through Spotify these days. It feels very, I don't know. It feels very something, but I just am. I think it's quite a good interface. And we also know that former ComCom, very briefly, ComCom producer Johnny Mouncer is a Spotify guy. So I always like to imagine Johnny hand delivering Spotify podcasts to my device. Cheers all. Thanks for that. And I'll chat to you in a sec, if you care to hang around for the 10 minutes or so of bullshit. So it's going to be 7 minutes tops of absolute bullshit, because I'm clock watching because I've got to take the Boutros swimming. What will I tell you about? I had a wonderful, wonderful show with Sofa So Funny. So the Infinite Sofa, as you'll remember, was the ludicrous thing that happened by accident and design, and created a sort of ultra collaborative late night chat show with an audience that became very, very involved and eventually kind of drove me insane. But lots of the people who became the core unit of that, a lot of them are ComCom fans, ComCom Facebook group members, and they created what was called the SoFam, the family of the sofa, and they all got to know each other far too well in some cases. And lovely Leslie Gold, who is a member of the SoFam and comedian, has organised this this night called Sofa So Funny, in which members of that community and members of the ComCom community have done some of their first ever gigs. I didn't see Wardy. I did see him, but I missed his gig. I met loads of people in the flesh for the first time. I thought that Ali Gibson was very, very funny on their second ever gig, which was good for them. That was really fantastic. And then I went on to have a really, really fun show. And it was one of those ones, and I've said this, I've said to Leslie, she can quote me on this. If you're listening to this as a comic, get in touch with Leslie. I think you can follow Sofa So Funny. There's probably some underscores in there, but you can Google it up. Get in touch with Leslie, because it's a room which is just full of comedy nerds. It's like a kind of tucked away room at a convention with the smell to match. And it's just a tiny little incredibly intense positive room. So what I said that Leslie could quote me on is that it is the sort of room in London. I think it's monthly, it might be bi-monthly. It's the sort of room where you don't really get an honest read on how good your stuff is because the audience is so supportive. But even those kind of rooms, like Old Rope, like other rooms besides, like Mac, it still works. You solve those. It's like you get all of the adrenaline of the audience, the audience's need for laughs, making you fix problems on stage, if you're one of the comics like me that does that. All of the adrenaline required for that, but sort of less risk somehow because it's so warm. So I had done a couple of new material gigs more recently, and then I took that stuff to the Sofa So Funny night, and lots of it clicked into place. So it's very satisfying. Thank you, Leslie, and all involved in that. And finally, with 4 minutes to go before I take the little guy swimming, I will tell you that coming up, we've got Sean McLaughlin. He's in the can. We've got Ria Lina. She's in the can. We've got Alison Spittle. Can. There's someone I'm so excited. I'm sort of talking to someone about getting an interview with someone, possibly a mere Zoom interview, with someone who I'm very excited about, who's doing a couple of nights in Edinburgh. So if you can work out who that is, answers on a postcard. Follow at ComComPod on Twitter or at Stuart Goldsmith Comedy on Instagram if you would like to be follower number 10,000 and something. What a satisfying thing that is. And I've got 2 hours to chop up, to make Callum chop up and stick out there as well. So, yes, that's all the socials. Ria, Alison and Sean, all cracking episodes. They're all coming up soon. And I am starting to be beset by Edinburgh, by PR agents in a way that I quite enjoy, where people are like, get this done. Everyone, now that everyone knows you can record a podcast online, the PRs have all ratcheted it up. Like, let's get it done before the festival. Let's get it done. Get it done right now. Which just goes to show, if you are paying for PR, and I know that certainly not everyone can afford to, and some people do it even though they can't afford to, and I question that, and some people can afford to, and then have an advantage based on money, but hey, it's the world. My point is simply that, yeah, some of you will be pleased to know your PRs are working hard for you. So I can at least meet them in the middle on that. Goodbye forever. That's the end of this episode. Next week, I think, is going to be Alison Spittle and then Ria and Sean and plenty more fun people besides. That's good. We blasted through it that time. I would love to tell you the people who I'm in conversations with for the live pod, but I think whoever we get, it will be great, because all of the current runners and riders are very, very funny indeed. So I will see you soon, but come and see me. Don't let me down. Bye.